from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This week, the Supreme Court voted to lift a nationwide injunction against the Trump administration's public charge policy, which makes it more difficult for immigrants to obtain a green card if they have used or are likely to use public benefits. It's the latest in a long list of Trump immigration policies over the past 3 years that either limit legal immigration or seek to deter asylum seekers from entering the United States. Here with me to talk about the impact of these policies, including the status of various lawsuits against the Trump administration, are Frida Javala Romero, who is immigration reporter for KQED News. Frida, welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Tyke Hendricks here with us in studio, senior editor who covers immigration for KQED and author of The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport, Stories from the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. Welcome, Tyke.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you both with us. Tyke, let me begin with you. The public charge policy and other policies limiting immigration, just update us.
Sure. And I think it's good to say, like, immigration has been a number one topic for President Trump, and there's been a lot of rhetoric and a lot of restrictions at the border. But something under the radar, I think, is a push to limit legal immigration. And I would say this public charge rule is part of that. For generations in this country, we've had a philosophy that immigrants shouldn't be a burden on the public, but the Trump administration has written a rule that expands that to say not just people who are fully dependent on welfare or cash benefits, but if you've ever used food stamps or a rental voucher or those kinds of things, then you wouldn't be eligible to get a green card, which is lawful permanent residence. And that's something that would apply both to people in the country who are trying to become permanent immigrants and also for, say, family members who are being sponsored by someone in the U.S. to come in. So this has been tied up in court, and just this week the Supreme Court said that the rule can go into effect, this more expansive, stricter version of public charge, while the lawsuits are going forward.
And I want to talk with you about the lawsuits, many of them, of course, from our Attorney General here in California, Becerra. But Frida, first let me go to you, and let's talk about the fact that this is now actually today, I believe, the anniversary of the MPP, the Migrant Protection Protocols, and put out by Homeland Security. I'm wondering where we stand on that because, you know, under the law, people are supposedly get their day in court where asylum is concerned. And there are many people not only who aren't getting their day in court, but even got their day in court and nothing has happened, transpired. They're there at the border.
Right. So this is, this is the one-year anniversary. 1 year ago, the Trump administration sent the first person back to Mexico under this program, a Honduran man. And since then, they've returned now about 59,000 people who were seeking asylum in the U.S., most of them Central American migrants who are low income. You know, they don't have the resources to fly into the U.S. and apply for a visa to get here. So this has been a policy that has really put, a big challenge for people at the border to try to access protections in the U.S. Immigration attorneys, a lot of people are very critical of this rule. They say that it really limits people's ability to get immigration attorneys, which is one of the key things that you need to win asylum in the U.S. It's a very complicated system, and people, you know, don't know how to defend themselves before an immigration judge. So it's really, affected people's ability to get asylum in this country. There's estimates by researchers at Syracuse University that say that only 0.2% of people have been able in this program have been able to win asylum in the U.S. Compared to about 30% who are able to win the protections when they arrive in the U.S. in another way.
But there's some who are actually nevertheless sent back despite the fact that they win. I mean, they wind up back in their home country.
Right. There's been reports about that. And the House Judiciary Committee is trying to investigate those reports.
Can I also ask you about the condition for these? Many of these people are living under terrible conditions. They're being preyed upon. They don't have shelter. They're living in squalid, terror, really.
Well, I mean, the main issue with this, you know, and from the beginning, and it's interesting, the administration calls it migrant protection protocols,
yes,
because a lot of people see it as, you know, we're really turning vulnerable immigrants to very dangerous areas of Mexico, you know, that the U.S. State Department is saying don't travel there at all, you know, is advising Americans to just not, don't go there. And that's where we're putting people through this program, like thousands of people, many of them women and children. CBP, the Customs and Border Protection, estimates that it's more than 20,000 people right now along the U.S.-Mexico border who are awaiting entry into the U.S. And so we're really talking about this, you know, creation of almost refugee camps, you know, in cities like Tijuana, Ciudad Juarez. There's not enough space at shelters for that many people. And we're hearing that many of them are living on the streets and unable to find work and feed their children.
Talking about immigration policies, and we'll give you an opportunity to join this conversation momentarily. But I want to go back to Taiki Hendricks, who, again, is senior editor covering immigration for KQED. And Taiki, what are we talking about in terms of lawsuits now, particularly that are imminent or really on the scope?
Well, there are so many. Farida and I are tracking a lot of them because many are filed in the federal courts in California, partly because our state government has filed a lot of these courts. The counties of San Francisco and Santa Clara were the first folks to challenge that public charge rule, the sort of wealth test on immigrants. And there have been a lot of other cases that are brought in California and also by California residents. But I think just to go back to this asylum question, we've seen almost a kind of a virtual wall. I think Trump has tried to build a physical wall at the border, but that hasn't been so successful. But there's been a series of this Remain in Mexico policy and a number of other rules and new policies have kind of created a virtual wall against people, all of these Central American families and children in particular who've been coming and looking for asylum. And
you don't have a physical wall, as the president promised in his campaign speeches, that was going to be built by Mexico or paid for by Mexico. What we do have, as you suggest, is kind of a virtual wall.
Right.
Yeah, a wall of rules.
Yeah, you can talk a little bit about that, Farida.
Yes. And I mean, just going back to your question, Michael, of like the lawsuits, there's challenges on this policy Remain in Mexico and other policies the Trump administration has implemented to really, you know, restrict who is able to get asylum in the U.S.
They're also constraining the judges, really, aren't they?
Well, there's, you know, the attorney general, like the head of the Department of Justice, and basically immigration judges are employees of the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. So the attorney general has issued, you know, attorney generals, because it was before Jeff
We're talking
Sessions.
About Barr now, who is
and Barr.
In this. Yeah.
Right. But they've issued, you know, like opinions basically telling immigration judges that victims of domestic violence are not, you know, that's not a grounds for asylum, or being part of a family that, you know, claims is being persecuted is not grounds for asylum. And some of those are also being challenged. But we've seen the Trump administration issue these type of rules that are pretty much like executive orders. You know, they're rules, but they didn't go through the rulemaking process of receiving public comment or, you know,
family separation.
Exactly.
Well.
Right. So many things seem to stem really from like, okay, we think this is an emergency. The Trump administration says, you know, people are gaming the asylum system, that many of them don't qualify for the protections, you know, that they're just coming here to get work. And so because of that and because of all of these people coming from Central America, they argue we're going to just do this now because it's an emergency. And we've seen rules like that just be rolled out, you know, really quickly.
And I would say this is, I mean, when Trump was running, as you were pointing out, he really had an anti-immigrant message that was a central part of his campaign. And we've had, talking to immigration scholars, legal scholars, like there have been anti-immigrant periods in U.S. history, going back to, the 20s especially. But in sort of modern history, this kind of rhetoric, and especially the very racialized tone of the rhetoric, I think is really unprecedented. And I've been watching, Farida and I have been watching as we've been covering this over these 3 years of, in some Trump administration policies in other areas, there's a little bit of maybe a scattershot kind of a an approach. But on immigration, it's been very methodical and very strategic and very effective and really sort of week by week, you know, new policies.
And very much following essentially the ideology of Stephen Miller, who is really behind so much of this.
Of both restricting illegal immigration, but also legal immigration. And we started with this travel ban on people from certain Muslim countries that was challenged a couple times in the courts, but is standing and may be expanded.
And it was the Supreme Court that allowed them to do that in 2018 as well.
Right. Slashing the numbers of refugees to the lowest numbers in history. Eliminating different kinds of humanitarian protections. There's something called temporary protected status for people from countries where there's been a civil war or an earthquake, natural disaster, saying, okay, you can stay temporarily. We won't deport you. You can have a work permit. And so there's several hundred thousand people in that category that they're trying to deport. And that's tied up in the courts. That's another example of a case in the courts. DACA is another example of that, with all of these – an Obama-era policy for people who were brought here as children by their parents unlawfully and giving them temporary protection from deportation. Trump has tried to eliminate that. That went to courts. And right now we're waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule this spring on whether Trump can end that. There are about 750,000 people in that program, and about a third of them are in California. So there's been this series, more detention of people. And then, as you were pointing out, I think family separation has really been one of the most controversial, where we saw, again, in an effort to keep people from coming to the southern border, a lot of these Central American families forcibly taking children away from their parents. We've heard stories in Border Patrol stations of agents wresting children from their parents, crying. And this was, you know, stopped by a judge, a federal judge in San Diego. And there's been a very protracted effort to reunite those families and figure out, like, how many families were affected and who are they and where are they. And it's about 5,500 kids were taken away, 5,000 or more kids. And they're still, 2 years on, not all reunited.
There's a kind of incompetence and paralysis that plays into this as well. I mean, you can't deny that, I think, in terms of locating the way that these families
and how
they are
connected. There were no systems in place to say,
they weren't thought through, really,
right,
about what
was going to happen. Who is the child and where's their parent? So this is part of a bigger sort of picture, I guess.
And we're taking a lot on and looking at the bigger picture here. I want to get our listeners involved, though. I know many of you may have questions and comments. And if you do, now is the time to let us know. What's your opinion of how the Trump administration has handled immigration? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. This is indeed controversial, but we do want to hear your opinions and any questions you might have. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have right now to forum@kqed.org. And let me go to a couple of emails. A listener writes, Supreme Court merely squelched the district court's injunctions against the public charge policy. The lawsuits against the policy will go forward. That's true,
right.
Thank you. Yeah. And another listener says, has no one else filled out legal immigration papers? When we sponsored a family member, I had to prove my income, that I can fully support them, and attest in writing that I would support them and they wouldn't use public assistance.
Well, I think it's, as I said, I mean, historically, that's been a premise of immigration policy, that we're not going to take people, we're just going to be a burden on the public. But this is a much more narrow definition of what that means to be a burden, and a much more restrictive approach. So, it's a shift in tone, I guess.
Here's a listener who writes, Trump's immigration policies have been popular with the public. It's one of the main issues that got him elected. Other candidates are soft on immigration. We don't necessarily have to get into political weeds here, but that's certainly what seems to be being brought up in terms of reelecting Donald Trump president.
Yeah, and I think this is an election year, and this, as I said, has been a defining feature of the Trump presidency, and it certainly has gotten a lot of resonance with a certain segment of the country.
It's kind of a lack of resonance, to use your words. I mean, in terms of
settlement. But I think it's a pretty – there's a lot of noise, you know, sort of on the extremes of the debate. But there's been public polling, too, that says, like, maybe there is some common ground here, and we haven't seen Congress find a way to meet in the middle or even attempt immigration legislation lately, but that maybe there is a more of a public sentiment that we need, you know, some sense of border security, but we can also be compassionate towards immigrants. So I feel like this is really going to be a defining question in this election.
I agree with you. And let's see what our callers have to say or ask. And we begin with Janine, who joins us from Sebastopol. Janine, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'm a green card holder. I'm from Canada, and I'm in the process of renewing my green card. It's been 8 months. I haven't heard back from them. And my question is I am wondering, because I've participated in the ACA, does that fall under public charge, and will that be a detriment to my personal case in renewing my green card?
Hi. Yes. Hi. I don't think so. I think for as of now, what's being considered as something that could hurt your ability to get a green card is as an adult being part of Medi-Cal or Medicaid, and then like long-term cash assistance, and then things like receipt of food stamps and maybe housing voucher programs. But it doesn't seem like to me that being part of the Affordable Care Act would affect that.
Janine, thank you for that question. Thank you. Want to add something here?
Well, just that we're not lawyers. So I believe that Farida is accurate, but I would consult an immigration lawyer.
Yeah, and I think that's what people are recommending the most, is that if people have concerns or questions, that they speak with an attorney. But, you know, this is an important point, because a lot of the concern about this public charge rule, because really, if you think about it, it's not going to affect asylees, refugees. You know, they're saying that immigrants who get these benefits for the U.S. citizen children should not be affected either, right? But the problem is that what a lot of advocates say is that it's causing a lot of fear and confusion, and that a lot of people are already dropping their benefits that they're eligible for out of, you know, just to be safe, so that it won't affect them in their immigration, whatever immigration process they have later on.
Let me thank Janine for her call. I think our next caller wants to talk about benefits, too, or welfare, at least. Carmen, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I'm confused about Trump trying to not let people be in the country or get citizenship if they've ever been on welfare, which is the old school term. First of all, you have to have all kinds of paperwork, as well as a Social Security number, to get that. And I think one of the persons that just spoke kind of cleared it up for me. It's if their kids that are citizenship get it. But it's really, you know, it's really, really hard. People aren't going to flood across the border and try to get food stamps and all that kind of stuff, because it's virtually even impossible for an American citizen to get that.
Now, Carmen, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the arguments you often hear is that, and you hear it from the right for the most part, is that people come into the country and they're suddenly living off what used to be called welfare.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, a lot of unauthorized immigrants are not eligible for most of the programs that we're talking about. So it wouldn't really, you know, they're already not getting those benefits.
And fair to say that use of public benefits is lower among immigrants overall, and workforce participation is generally higher than it is for the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, and look, like, we live in a state with the most immigrants in the entire country. It's like close to 11 million people. Half of the children in California have at least one parent who's an immigrant, you know, and that's according to the Public Policy Institute of California. So it's a lot of families that are going to be wondering whether they should keep, you know, their benefits, even if it's for, you know, U.S. citizen kids, out of fear that it's going to affect them later on, especially if the Trump administration continues.
Let me ask about a bigger question here, since we wanted to take a look at the 3 years of the Trump immigration policies, particularly as the public charge rule has been upheld. Where do you see all this going? I mean, obviously we have an election ahead of us, but aside from that, we've been through quite a lot here just in the last 3 years. Extraordinary amount.
Yeah, I think it's been a period of really pretty epic changes. But I think I've talked to various people, people who study this stuff, and one person has said, you know, it could take a generation to change these policies back if a new administration wanted to do that. But other people have pointed out that these are not legislation. This is not new laws because Congress can't get on the same page about this stuff. So mostly it's executive directives, executive actions, and then rules. And it can take a couple of years to do a rule or to undo a rule. So that could take some time. But it's not irreversible, but there's just such a volume of this stuff.
I'm going to read a quick tweet here from a listener who says, Trump administration immigration policy is sociopathic. We need to create greater awareness of the tremendous positive impact of immigration on our economy from a policy perspective. Frida?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's been just so much attention on immigration, you know, and at the same time, there's a number of other big changes that are happening, you know, in terms of the environment, science, like other types of regulation that the federal government does. And sometimes I just, you know, wonder a little bit as like a regular, you know, listener or like person living in this country, like we're putting a lot of, at least what I cover is immigration, but at the same time, it seems like there's a lot of other changes for sure happening.
Taki mentioned all this legal immigration under the radar that is being averted.
I mean, there's proposals to increase the fee to naturalize, to
like
double
it.
You know, to make it more than $1,000 to apply to become a U.S. citizen, which is going to, you know, definitely make it harder for a lot of people to be able to take that step. And the public charge rule is also really, it's concerning for a lot of people because in order to become a naturalized citizen as an immigrant, you have to first be a green card holder. So eventually, if you can't get a green card, you can't naturalize, which means you can't vote. You know,
those are sort of the steps to take to really, you know, integrate and, you know, become a full participating member of this country and the society.
Yeah.
Let me bring another caller aboard from Santa Rosa. We welcome Namiko. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for seeing this. I am a current green card holder and was priorly a DACA recipient. And I echo the sentiment being stated in this program that, yeah, I mean, the system is not made for poor people. It's not just to count lawyer fees, but recently they have also ruled out an increase in the application for a green card, the cost of the application to over $1,000. In addition to the work permit costs. And you have to make a minimum. You have to make a certain amount of money to be able to even qualify. So to me, the system is intrinsically classist. So when people make statements such as, well, just get legal, you know, it's like I'm married to a citizen. But it's people are like, oh, don't you automatically get your green card when you're married? So just wanted to point that out to the public. In addition to a lot of different blood tests that you have to go through, you know, the hepatitis and B or whatever. They test you for a bunch of stuff, which to me is like, you know, seems a bit racist in and of itself. But that'll take my comment off the air.
Well, Namiko, thank you. It's good to hear from you. Anybody want to respond to her comment?
Yeah, I mean, it's not only proposals to significantly increase the cost of applying for many of these immigration benefits, like getting a green card, which allows you to work in this country, you know, to like be able to change your jobs, you know, and be a little more free, you know, in what you do here. But the administration is also proposing to eliminate most of the fee waivers and fee cost like reductions that they had in place before.
There used to be hardship waivers for people who
right.
Were
so
low
it's not
income,
it's not only that it's
going to pay the full fee. Yeah.
It's going to cost more. Is that it's also there's going to be fewer, you know, like people who don't make that kind of money and are unable to pay that. Just can't get any help. They just have to live with the cost. I want to go back to like your question about, you know, like the 3 year, you know, looking at immigration. And I think
I want to get into the big picture here.
Yeah,
what is ahead of us, but also in addition to what the last 3 years have provided or not provided.
I think for me, this is really a test of executive power. And now that, you know, we're hearing a lot about like the impeachment and this is a test for how like the U.S. political system, you know, works and what it's supposed to like withstand, you know. And in this case, like Taiki mentioned, a lot of these like changes that are being implemented now by the federal government are because of executive, you know, rules, because of an agency saying, OK, we're going to do this and here we go. Right. And then it gets challenged in the courts or whatever. Maybe it'll get stopped, but many of these policies are being implemented, like the Remain in Mexico policy. And so, I mean, we're really seeing, like, in live, you know, action here, like the executive branch branch of the government just taking the initiative and a lot of these big changes. And we're not, the courts are stepping in, but like in some cases, like in the Remain in Mexico or public charge, you know, it may take like years for the thing to be decided on its merits at the court level. And so for now, we have, you know, these policies being you know, put into place and affecting people's lives, you know, thousands of people at the southern border that we know of.
So, what about the argument that one hears, and this, again, is going to certainly take shape in the presidential election, that sustainability has to be, you know, a major factor in terms of immigration policy, that, in other words, sustainability is the key to the republic's survival and the republic continuing and so forth. There are a lot of places where immigrants could go and settle, but most of them settle in cities and big cities. And so you do have a real challenge in terms of sustaining.
Well, I guess, I mean, what is sustainability can be interpreted a lot of different ways. And there's been a sort of a philosophical discussion of, you know, is it are immigrants a burden or a benefit to the society? And
you could argue both ways. They do. They have on this program.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence that immigrants are, by and large, bring an economic stimulus with work and ideas and so forth.
Pay taxes.
You know, use fewer public benefits. That doesn't mean that they don't use any public benefits. And
there is an anger, though, in a lot of Americans. You know, mm-hmm. we live in a bubble here, and a lot of that anger says these are people who came in this country illegally. They're illegal. We call them undocumented, but this is what one hears in the rhetoric. Therefore, why should we provide for them? Why should we even have them feeling entitled to be part of our country?
Yeah, and you see that argument in a lot of the justifications that the Trump administration gives for implementing these policies. So, for example, in public charge, they say, well, we want to protect taxpayer resources and we want, you know, immigrants should be self-sufficient, you know, and have like the same deal as everybody else and not get like an extra, you know, hand to survive in this country. The irony with like, you know, arguments like that and when the government is putting them in place, you know, like with the public charge rule, is that, you know, a lot of people that work in public benefits say if you're unemployed or temporarily or, you know, get hurt in your job, you might need these benefits to be okay in the long term, you know, like
to be a productive person and to be able
to continue to pay taxes and stuff. So in California, and I think that's why Santa Clara and San Francisco, like these, you know, counties with a lot of immigrants in California sued to stop the public charge rule because they see the cost of, you know, the increasing cost of if people are not being able to use these benefits might come to the local governments is what they're, you know.
We will have to leave it there. Taiki, Farida, thank you both for being with us this morning on Forum. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Michael.
And stay tuned. We're going to be doing coverage, live coverage of what's going on in Washington with the impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump. And we'll talk about that tomorrow as well as the 49ers. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.